And now I've totally lost my train of thought, but that's okay. I'm going to edit it out on the recorded version.
You are listening to Bible Stories for Grownups, a class where we dive into the Bible one story at a time. This class is recorded live at St. John's Episcopal Church in downtown Tallahassee. Learn more about St. John's at www.st-john.org. I'm your host and teacher, Father Lonnie Lacey. Let's get started.
The Lord be with you. Let us pray. O God and Father of all believers, for the glory of your name, multiply by the grace of the Paschal Sacrament the number of your children, that your church may rejoice to see fulfilled your promise to our father Abraham through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. Well, hi, everybody. Let's get into things. Y'all know what I always say at the beginning of every session. My three rules for reading. Number one, look for why. Yes, look, you nailed it. Look for God because, yes, he is always the most interesting character. If you can get good at looking for God in the Bible, then you also start to get good at looking for God in your daily life. So always be asking yourself, what is God up to here? Number two, look for grace. Why? Awesome. Because God is always up to something good. Even when the story is a hard one, even when things look bleak, God's long-term plan is one of grace. And I think we can and should always be looking at that long-term plan and figuring out how does this story figure into that. But also within even the hard stories, there can be graces that we can take away for our daily life. And then finally, number three, let's see if y'all nail this one. Keep God nearby. Yes, because God is not dead. God is alive. We worship a living God. This is the living word. You are the living people of God. God is in this room with us. God has things to say to you tonight. So don't treat this like it's a old history course or a study in mythologies. This is the true word of the living God. All right, a little bit of review. We're going to be getting into Genesis 12 tonight, but before we do that, what we have done so far since we opened up the Bible is we have dealt with what I would call the origin narratives. We have read creation. We read about Adam and Eve. We read about sin. We read about Cain and Abel, their sons, one of whom murdered the other. We read about Noah's Ark and the Tower of Babel. All of these stories were really designed to show us the ancient Hebrew mindset. It gives us a great little peek into their worldview, but they were also designed to explain why things are the way they are. Why do we deal with the problem of sin and struggling with our relationships with one another, with ourselves, and with God? We also caught some little glimpses in there about the emergence of, are we going to be an agrarian people and settle into a space and plant our crops here and live off the land permanently? Or are we going to be a nomadic people and follow our herds around? All of these kind of early human history things really kind of come to the fore. And last week, we got all the way to their story of why it is that we are a diverse people across the known world. Why do we speak different languages? Why do we have different perspectives? All of those I would call the origin narratives, but tonight we shift. Tonight begins the story of Abram and Sarai, who will later become known as Abraham and Sarah. And so tonight is the fulcrum into the next portion of Genesis. I think a lot of people think about Genesis and they know that there are stories like Adam and Eve. Maybe they know that Noah's Ark is in there. And so we think that it's just one little story after another little story after another little story. But actually, it's kind of three different sections. That first section of those origin narratives, this next section that we're going into with the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Now, we should actually say the patriarchs and matriarchs. And then that leads into a massive chunk of Genesis, which is the story of Joseph and his brothers. So big, big, big shift tonight. And I'm going to have us read chapter 12 in two different chunks. Before we hear it, here's the question that I want you to be thinking about. God is going to make some monumental promises to Abram. What are they? Just be looking for the promises, okay? We have a friend new to the parish, Christine, who has volunteered to read tonight. So, Christine, come on down.
The call of Abram. The Lord had said to Abram, "Leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land I will show you. I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you." So Abram left as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he set out from Haran. He took his wife, Sarai, his nephew Lot, all the possessions they had accumulated and the people they had acquired in Haran, and they set out for the land of Canaan, and they arrived there. Abram traveled through the land as far as the site of the great tree of Moreh of Shechem. At that time, the Canaanites were in the land. The Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your offspring I will give this land." So he built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him. From there he went on toward the hills east of Bethel and pitched his tent, with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. There he built an altar to the Lord and called on the name of the Lord. Then Abram set out and continued on toward Negev.
All right. Thank you, Christine. So God has called Abram. My question to you was, God's going to make some promises to Abram here. These are really important promises. What are the promises that God makes to Abram? What did you notice? "I will make you a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great.
Whoever curses you will be cursed.
I will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you." So starting there at verse 2, "I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed." My Old Testament professor at Virginia Seminary, Judy Fentress Williams, had what I thought was a wonderful way of putting this. And I don't know if she got it from somebody else, but the way she put it was, the promise to Abram is property, progeny, and prosperity. I'm going to give you land. I'm going to give you children. And I'm going to give you blessings. I'm going to make you prosperous. And prestige. Ooh, add prestige into that. I will make your name famous. Yeah. So I'm going to call my Old Testament professor at VTS and tell her to add that to the list. Let's look at these a little more closely. Starting really at verse 1. "Now the Lord said to Abram, 'Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you.'" Do you find anything remarkable about verse 1? I'll read it to you again. The verse that comes before these monumental blessings from the living God to this one individual, the first words before that are, "Now the Lord said to Abram, 'Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you.'" Do you find anything remarkable or puzzling about that? Jen, you're nodding your head. What do you... He's going to have to leave everything he knows. Yeah, big, big, big promises, really big. but you're going to have to leave everything you know. What else do y'all notice or wonder about in that sentence?
Jesus said to his disciples.
Yeah, that is what Jesus said to his disciples. Leave it all. Come follow me.
But Abram had to have strong faith to do that.
He would have had to have had strong faith to do that. Yeah.
He doesn't necessarily tell him where he's going at first. But where are you sending me, God? Hold on, I'll get back to you.
Yeah, does not necessarily tell him where he's even going to send him. I'll show you, but not just yet.
You got to commit first, and then I'll show you where you're going.
Yeah, you got to commit first, and then I'll show you where you're going. True life parallel here. I was in a position this week of having to make a very large decision regarding moving my dad to town here. He still lives in Tifton, and we found a nice place for him to be here. And, you know, these things cost money. And the price that I was given for the first year was superb. But I was told, now this is a 20% discount. And I said, well, what happens at the end of next year when the 20% discount goes away? Does that mean that the price is going to jump really high? And they said, oh, we'll deal with that when we get to that. And I said, oh, will we? And I said, you got to give me better assurances than that in black and white. Had I been Abram, I would have said, you got to give me better assurances in black and white. I want to see what you're going to do with me. Don't just tell me it's going to be okay. Eric.
I was just going to say this was a huge leap of faith because only God knew how everything was going to work out.
Yeah. Huge leap of faith because only God knew how everything was going to work out.
Is he sending Abram where someone else already lives?
He is sending Abram where somebody else already lives.
And what about them?
And what about them? That's going to be a question all the way through Exodus and is still a question to this day. And when I say question, I mean, yeah, a really tough question. All right, so here's the other thing that I just want to say about all of this. You know, we're one verse in and we're already unpacking all of this about Abram and making these good assumptions about the level of faith that he had. But, you know, in some ways it's like, who is this guy? Now, a couple of verses before, like Roger said, Abram comes up. We get his lineage. We are given some connective tissue to the people who came before him, But it is remarkable that God looks at this one person and says, you're going to be my guy. And through you, the whole course of the world is going to not just be changed, but really set. It's also just interesting that it just flat out says, now the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred. You don't get any kind of introduction like, hey, Abram, my name is the Lord. And I know we've not met yet, but I want to tell you about myself and about some things that I've got in store for you. And I'd like to know what you think about that. Instead, God just shows up. Now, we can make the assumption that therefore Abram knew the Lord, that the Lord was well known to Abram and his household at that point. But it, to me, it's just this stark imperative. God opens God's mouth and says, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. That's a big commandment. Therefore, it speaks to a lot of trust. The other thing that I would say within these first three verses where it says, I will make of you a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you and I will curse those who curse you. Obviously, that's, you know, the word will, it's speaking to a future promise. Abram's going to have to live in the in-between time because just because something is promised doesn't mean it's going to be delivered right then and there. But the other thing about that I will is repetition is Hebrew's version of bold type. This is a God who is not just saying, I think I'm going to do this for you, and I think I'm going to do that for you. It is, I will do this. Because it's said over and over and over, it just takes the promise deeper and deeper and deeper. This is a God who is making deep promises that you can count on, even though they're going to take time to be fulfilled. So let's look a little further. Let's look at verses 4-9 again. What are the first three words that y'all have in your versions in verse 4? So Abram went. God just shows up in verse 1 and says, go from your country. And in verse 4, so Abram went. What does that tell you about Abram? We've kind of already said it, but what does that tell you about Abram? Faith in God, he's obedient. Yeah. So God comes and makes this huge demand along with these big promises, and Abram just picks up and goes. Who does he take with him? Lot. And does anybody remember who Lot is? It's his nephew. Yeah. So in verse 5, Abram took his wife Sarah and his brother's son Lot and all the possessions that they had gathered and the persons whom they had acquired in Haran. So yeah, he takes his wife, his nephew, and presumably their slaves as well.
Abram was 75 when he
started. Yes, and he's 75 when he starts this out. We might as well, let's just read all of these so we hear them. So Abram went, as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. Abram took his wife Sarai and his brother's son Lot, and all the possessions that they had gathered, and the persons whom they had acquired in Haran, and they set forth to go to the land of Canaan. And to Valerie's question, yep, there are people living there. When they had come to the land of Canaan, Abram passed through the land to the place at Shechem, to the oak of Moreh. And at that time, the Canaanites were in the land. Bingo, there they are. So God is taking him to a land that is already occupied. We are not going to be able to solve that conundrum tonight, or maybe ever. Then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your offspring I will give this land. So he built an altar to the Lord. We'll get to that in just a second. I want to ask about Lot a little bit more. Why do you think he takes Lot? Why do you think he takes his nephew? Because they don't have any children. If they don't have any children, and it seems they can't have any children, what's the benefit of taking somebody like Lot? So he can have children. See, you cut right to it. Because I thought the answer y'all would give is he took Lot because he needs another ranch hand on the ranch. But the other part may be that there is this part of Abram saying, okay, I know you said progeny, but I wonder if maybe I need to hedge my bets and take this kid with me because he can be part of my household and he can have kids beyond me.
Well, his father was dead. His father died before his grandfather. Because it says so. So his father had died.
Lot's father had died?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. So there's also that. That would mean that he then needs to adopt Lot into his household. So he takes Lot partially because Lot is his nephew and doesn't have a father, and therefore it is custom for him to adopt him into his household. He may also be sort of wiping his brow saying, whew, glad Lot's with me because he can help me out. But also, you may be wondering, is this how God is going to do what God said God's going to do? We don't know. Just sort of wondering. So they pass through Canaan, and God says, by the way, this is it. To your offspring, I'm going to give this land. How does Abram respond? In verse 7, then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your offspring, I will give this land. What does Abram do? He builds an altar. Well, and then he does it again. In the next verse, it says, from there he moved on to the hill country on the east of Bethel and pitched his tent with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. And there he built an altar to the Lord and invoked the name of the Lord. And Abram journeyed on by stages toward the Negev. He builds an altar. In fact, he does it twice. What does this say to us about Abram?
But at the same time, I think he's also sort of like, okay, keep saying offspring, fine, I'll do this, keep it moving, let's keep going, you know, like.
Okay, so it shows that he has tremendous faith in God, but it's also maybe, you know, God has said, I'm going to do this for you. So Abram's like, okay, fine, then to keep this thing going, I'll build this, almost kind of a reciprocal sort of thing, try to keep this train on the tracks, try to keep God not happy. I mean, but you know, yeah, to stay in relationship with this God who's made these promises. What else does this say to you about Abram?
I'm just wondering if he's kind of laying a claim as he moves around, he's building altars.
Okay, kind of wondering if he's laying a claim as he's moving through this land, building these altars.
Everybody else. I mean, Abraham has been called the first monotheist. He erects an altar and he invokes the name of Yahweh. And by doing so, he says, Yahweh is God.
Mm-hmm.
Not all those gods back in the old country.
All right, so did y'all catch that? He's coming from a culture that is almost certainly polytheistic. Everybody was polytheistic. As David said, Abram was called the first monotheist. And so part of what he's doing is laying claim to the one God, Yahweh. He invokes the name of this Lord, this God in this place. And so this huge statement of faith, not just in gods, but in God. Yeah, yeah.
In Genesis, God just sets those rules of what he wants for humans, and it's to thank and praise God. So he builds this altar. Now, God didn't say to build an altar, but there are a lot of rocks in that country, so it's a way of setting things up. And
so it seems in everything that we've read so far that God's priority, at least one of, if not the main priority, is that he wants praise and thanks from humanity. And so this is what Abram is doing in building this altar. He's offering praise and thanks to God with the resources that are around him. There are rocks all over the place. So a little pile of rocks over here, a little pile of rocks over here, maybe a big pile of rocks. Okay. So Melanie says we should not lose sight of the fact that the Lord appeared to Abram. And he wanted to mark that, which that's a tricky thing in the Old Testament, especially in Genesis. God shows up a lot, and we have to puzzle through what that means. He's going to show up again in the form of three beings in just a little while. He showed up in the garden in Tower of Babel. Didn't we talk last week about how it says he came down? So whatever that looked like, Abram said, all right, we better mark this spot. This is an important spot. So yeah, I think at a minimum, we are seeing this man who has walked away from everything he knew and has gone out on faith at God's command. And so we see tremendous faith going on here. And these altars are marks of faith. And I just wonder what that looks like for us. I'm not even asking you to respond. This is really just for you to kind of think about and ponder in your heart. If Abram built altars as he journeyed by stages with God, what does it look like for you to build altars as you journey by stages with God through your life? How do you mark the sacred moments, the sacred spaces? Where do you recognize that God has shown up in your life and do something about it? Because these may be monuments, they may be, there may be a lot of words we could use to describe them, but they are at least a response from Abram saying, this was important. I saw God here. I need to be able to remember this. How do you mark and remember the places where God has shown up in your life, or the times where God has shown up in your life? There's no right answer about that, but I just kind of think it's important for us to think about how we journey by stages with God through life. God shows up. How do you mark that? How do you remember it? How do you hold it dear? All right, let's look at 10 through 20. I'm going to ask Christine to come back up for this one. All of this has sounded really good. Abram seems full of faith and just seems like a stand-up guy. But now there's a problem. God has promised land, but you'll see in the very first verse of what we're about to read, there's a famine. And so Abram gets worried about some things and starts to hatch a plan, and things go a little hinky. And we got to puzzle through what that means with all the stuff we've been saying about how fine and faithful Abram is.
Now there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down to Egypt to live there for a while because the famine was severe. As he was about to enter Egypt, he said to his wife Sarai, I know what a beautiful woman you are. When the Egyptians see you, they will say, this is his wife. Then they will kill me, but they will let you live. Say you are my sister, so that I will be treated well for your sake, and my life will be spared because of you. When Abram came to Egypt, the Egyptians saw that she was a very beautiful woman. And when Pharaoh's officials saw her, they praised her to Pharaoh, and she was taken into his palace. He treated Abram well for her sake. And Abram acquired sheep and cattle, male and female donkeys, manservants and maidservants, and camels. But the Lord inflicted serious diseases on Pharaoh and his household because of Abram's wife Sarai. So Pharaoh summoned Abram. What have you done to me? He said. Why didn't you tell me she was your wife? Why did you say she is my sister, so that I took her to be my wife? Now then, here is your wife. Take her and go. Then Pharaoh gave orders about Abram to his men, and they sent him on his way with his wife and everything he had.
Straight out of an episode of reality TV. It's just bizarre. And it's going to come up again. The story is going to get repeated. And I will probably have a skip it when it comes up again. Because either Abram just has a hard time learning, or just in the way things were put together editorially, it happened to be told twice. But let's deal with it tonight. This is Bible Stories for Grownups. So we read the parts that they don't read in the kindergarten version of Sunday school. So there are usually two camps with this story. There can be more than two, but the two broad camps are, on this side, Abram was understandably afraid. He's in a foreign land, in danger, no food, and knows that the powers that be will see Sarai's beauty and kill him so they can take her. So he passes her off as his sister, and then unfortunate things ensue. That's one camp. Another camp is, or Abram was a coward, and he put his wife in great jeopardy and put her honor and her safety up as a shield for his own safety. Understandable, coward. You got to choose. I'm going to make you vote here. Unfair, I know. But who says understandable? I mean, dangerous situation, and he knows that he'll probably get killed. Y'all are precious. You're like, I don't know. Should I? Yeah, okay. Mike is bold. He's just, yes, I'm in that camp. All right. And then other camp, which ones of y'all are in the... No, stupid coward, put his wife in jeopardy to shield himself. Yeah, how many of you did not vote? How many of you vote for both? Okay,
manipulative is the right word. He was planning. He just thought, I need these things. And if I kind of offer Sarai, I'm going to get more things.
Okay.
That property I'm going to get taken care of.
Right. So I need these things. I'm in a barren land. I need these things to survive. I mean, even if you just put pause on the promises that God has made, which we can't and shouldn't, but even if we did, there's a famine in the land. They're going to starve to death if he doesn't do something. And naturally, going to Pharaoh, the one who holds all the grain and all the resources, and go and ask for help. Maybe he's just trying to plan out, how can I do this? That then means, well, we'll get into some of the complications of that, but yeah, could be that he's just trying to figure out what to do. Val?
Well, I know we'll come to other stories, but it seems to me worth mentioning that there are a lot of issues with hospitality and also with how women are treated. And that this is basically, she goes to Pharaoh's house and he's given a lot of stuff. That's pretty transactional.
Yes.
And it will happen later, you know, when stranger visitors are protected, but the host says, here's my daughters. Go
right.
Crazy.
Right. Yeah. So culturally, we're dealing with a time when women are more on the property side than on the relationship side. And this does look very transactional. I need these things. Here's my wife. That is uncomfortable. And these are the moments where we realize in Bible Stories for Grown-Ups that just because it's in the Bible doesn't mean it's the way things are supposed to be. A dear friend of mine, Father Jim Schumard, I remember he once said, if it's family values you're looking for, don't go looking in the Bible, because there's all this kind of crazy stuff. So, yeah.
Seems like his faith is faltering a little bit. You know, things did not work out just right in Canaan, so he takes it upon himself for this plan to go to Egypt. You know, God did not tell him to go to Egypt, and he there's nothing about any other alternatives.
Okay, so seems like his faith may be faltering, and so it may be that he's beginning to take things into his own hands and goes to Egypt. God did not say to go to Egypt, but he goes to Egypt and is trying to work this thing out himself, which may tell us something about whether his faith is maybe getting a little shaky. Did I see? Yes, and I'll make my way over.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting, too, that he's saying, say that you're my sister so that it may be well for me, for your sake. And I thought that was pretty manipulative. And that way my soul shall live because of you.
Yeah, say that you're my sister so that I will be safe for your sake.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, for her sake. I'm doing you a favor, honey. Bye. Oh, let me come back around. All right, there was somebody else before. No, okay. Yep. So why did God punish Pharaoh? A mystery for the ages. We won't get that figured out, but we do need to talk about that. Eric.
It just reminds me of like instances you see with Moses or the disciples. I'm thinking especially Peter, where they didn't have faith in a moment that they needed to, but they were still able to accomplish great things for God, that it kind of reminds us we're going to have those moments as people too. Maybe not quite one like this, but, you know, we'll have our moments.
Yes, okay. Eric says we might also have moments like this, and Melanie says definitely not like this one. The Bible is filled with people who are struggling. They've heard the promises of God, but they're trying to figure out, okay, but how? And how much agency do I have in this? What do I need to do here to deal with this situation? Which, have you never felt like that? I mean, have you never struggled with, okay, I know God is going to give me the daily bread, but the budget's real tight this month. We've struggled with these kinds of things before. Val?
I mean, foreshadowing, he King David does what Pharaoh, what Abram is afraid Pharaoh is going to do. He does it. He kills Uriah. He loves Bathsheba.
That's true.
And it's,
yeah,
that's what he's fearful of.
Foreshadowing beloved King David, who they to this day still say was the greatest king of Israel who ever lived, did exactly to Uriah what Abram is afraid Pharaoh is going to do to him. Yeah. So problems all through the whole darn book. Yeah.
Going to Egypt is a recurring theme. There's a mythic theme there, like I was talking about last week. There's a mythic theme about going to Egypt. We go to Egypt when things get bad where we are. Abraham goes, Abram. Well, he's, by now is he Abraham?
He's still Abram.
He's still Abram. Okay, so Abram goes to Egypt. But then they send, Jacob sends his sons to Egypt. And they're too far too long. And then... isn't there a time in during the wars between the kings and the divided kingdom when they're trying to go to Egypt and bargain for, hey, Pharaoh, can you help us out with your army? And then, of course, Jesus goes to Joseph and Mary take Jesus.
When the going gets tough, Egypt seems to be the place we go, for better or worse, and usually for worse. It is the place that the people of God seem to say, all right, well, maybe they've got it figured out. The grass is greener over in Egypt. Let's go over there. So yeah, definitely a recurring theme. And ultimately, they're going to get trapped there. I won't spoil the end of Genesis and all of Exodus, but yeah, Egypt is a touchstone of anxiety for the people of God.
So perhaps with that question of the ages, God needed Abraham to get on with the plan, and as long as they were there, that wasn't going to happen. So he puts plagues upon Pharaoh so that Pharaoh decides to get them out of here, and get thee away from me.
So to the question of the ages, which, okay, let's demote it to just under question of the ages, but still a really good question. God needs Abram to get on out of there, and God needs to protect Abram. And so he puts these plagues on Pharaoh so that Pharaoh will say, get on, you got to go. There's also some foreshadowing here. I mean, Val's used the word foreshadowing a couple times, but there's foreshadowing here of what will happen in Exodus. All right, so the truth is, let's just back up for half a second. In terms of, was Abram understandably afraid and he's just trying to figure this out, or is he a coward? Truth is, it's an impossible scenario. And so he's got to do something, but it doesn't mean that the something he does is good or right. For you Star Trek nerds in the room, this is the Kobayashi Maru. You're welcome, Val. So as we've noted, there are other issues here. For all Abram's faithfulness so far, everything we read in the beginning of chapter 12 where we're like, he's just great. This guy's just full of faith. Look at him building altars, doing exactly what God says without any question. For all his faithfulness so far, he's now up against a famine. So there goes prosperity. The land is barren. So there goes property. And his wife is also barren, which we were told in Genesis 11:30 before we got into this chapter. So there goes progeny. Those three promises of prosperity, property, and progeny. If you're Abram, it could be that you're having a little bit of a crisis of faith here. So it could be that he does what we all do, which is, as was already said tonight, he takes matters into his own hands. And I want you to look at the juxtaposition of these two things, the difference between building altars and taking matters into our own hands. That's why I was a little thrown off by the question of, was he building altars in order to make his mark Because when I think of him building altars, I think of him making God's mark. That when you're using your hands to build an altar to God, an altar has no purpose other than for worship and perhaps sacrifice, which for them was part of worship. This table here, we could do other stuff with it, but we don't. We're not going to play ping pong on it. We're not going to use it as a desk. This table that's up here is more than a table. It's an altar. It sits there solely to be the focus of giving glory to God. And so if we use our hands to build altars in the world, then we're using our hands to put our faith, our trust in God's glory and providence and goodness toward us. Or we can take matters into our own hands. What do we use our hands to do? It seems Abram is taking matters into his own hands here. Notice in verse 18, so Pharaoh called Abram and said, "What is this you have done to me?" Does that remind you of any other moments that we've read? I mean, it's kind of a deep cut here. Melanie, you're nodding your head. What does that remind you of? Uh-huh.
What is this you have done? The blood of your brother.
Yes. Yeah. In the Cain and Abel story, it's the exact same question that God asks of Cain. What is this that you have done? Your brother's blood cries out to the ground for me. And take a couple steps back from that, it's the exact question that God asks Adam. And so it's just interesting that Pharaoh's question mirrors that of God. Pharaoh definitely is not God in this equation, but that we get a very similar question being put to this man who we've said has such great faith. So why does God punish Pharaoh? The reason I say it's a question for the ages is because we won't come up with a totally satisfactory answer. Is it fair? No. But does God always do things that are fair in all of this? No. And in some sense of God's justice, Pharaoh is doing something wrong by taking this woman to be his wife, who is somebody else's wife. But it's not like Pharaoh knew that. So I don't know, man. I don't know.
Could it be that it's part of the very promise that God made at the beginning? In my text, it says, "I will bless those who bless you and curse those who treat you with contempt."
So it could be that this is attached to the very promise that God made in the beginning. I will bless those who bless you and I will curse those who curse you, whether they knew what rules they were playing by or not. So that could be it. God's sense of justice in all of this is not exactly our sense of justice. Whitney, you're the last one, then I'm going to ask us for graces and takeaways.
So, given my limited knowledge, but it almost seems like Egypt is the proverbial thorn in God's side, like, all the time. Okay, now we're going back into Egypt. And it seems like almost in a way that the Egyptians, Pharaoh, etc., are almost, I don't even want to say a threat to God, but it's like, they were a very, very successful civilization. So it's just sort of like, he's like, okay, now I got to deal with this again. You know, like, so it's just like kind of a consistent situation.
Okay. So Whitney's wondering if Egypt is sort of like the proverbial thorn in God's side, that Egypt was a very successful civilization. And God is saying, ugh, I got to deal with this again. I think that's a great question, great observation. I would take it and turn it just a hair and say that in some ways, Egypt is, if not neutral, Egypt itself is not the focus. It's not the thorn. The thorn in God's side is his faithful people being unfaithful, which then lands them in Egypt, which then makes it to where God is like, okay, I'm going to have to get them out of this one. And he has to do it more than once. But I think it's the unfaithfulness of his faithful people that is the real thorn in God's side. So what is your takeaway? We've heard in one chapter these two very different-ish stories of Abram. We have this man of great faith where when God says, pick up and go, he picks up and he goes. And he builds altars to the Lord, and he's trusting in the now quatrefold promise of property, prosperity, progeny, and prestige. And then just a couple verses later, it seems like he's worried. He's trying to fix things. He may be thinking, I don't know how all those are going to work out. I just know I've got to deal with this, to the point where he puts his own wife in real jeopardy. What's your takeaway here? What do you take from this chapter tonight and say, that makes sense for my life? Life is messy. Well said. Life is messy.
Even people that God chooses falter.
Even people that God chooses falter. And boy, howdy, how we're going to see that over and over and over for the rest of Genesis and really for the rest of the Bible.
And God has his own timing, because I actually have a gift of prophecy, and I second guess, and I go all over the map trying to hedge my bets.
God's timing is God's timing. It's not our timing. Even the prophets can second guess and wonder and worry. What else? What other takeaways?
Well, that's an example of God's grace. Here he was. He blew his opportunity to show his faith. He failed, but yet God was still willing to pick him up afterwards to carry on.
So good job looking for the graces. This is an instance of God's grace where Abram blows it. He totally messes up here, and yet God remains faithful to him, gets him out of this bind, and remains faithful to him. What Abram does not nullify the promises. I think that's critical. That's maybe the biggest grace of all.
What a lonely person Abram must have been. Doesn't speak at all about any friends. And his only person, or whatever we want to call God, that he visits with is God. And I keep thinking, where are all these other people that he brought in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
Are they just sitting around twiddling their thumbs? Seems like there would have been a great gathering somewhere. He would have said, hey, Abram, we're behind you. Remember what God said.
So it seems like Abram may be lonely. This story is told in such a way that it's so focused on him, makes you wonder, where are all those people that went with him? Leadership is lonely, and it may be that where those people are is they're hungry, and he's trying to figure out, how am I going to deal with this? But it would be nice if they said, Abram, we're with you. How can we help? God did keep them alive and fed. Yeah, Winifred.
What did you say? God's mercy and grace to Abram, because he made the mess, but he punished, because he's his chosen one. He made the other man sick.
Yeah, yeah. God's mercy and grace toward Abram, his chosen one, which means he made Pharaoh sick, which feels unfair. This is why it's a conundrum. This is why we'll never get the question totally figured out in a way that satisfies us. But what it does is it points to God's mercy and grace for Abram. For me, the takeaways and graces are, number one, perhaps we can identify with Abram. We are not perfect. Sometimes we're walking through this life building altars to God, and sometimes we're walking through this life worried and anxious, taking things into our own hands. Has that never happened to you? Of course it has. So we can identify with Abram. Two, the crisis of faith did not nullify the promises. God's promises to you are still just as true today. Makes me think of those three babies we baptized on Sunday. They are now irrevocably part of Christ's body, the church. They are sealed by the Holy Spirit in baptism and marked as Christ's own forever. Nothing they do in their life can take that promise away from them now. And then number three, as was stated, God's promises can take a while. That's a very frustrating grace, but I think it is a grace. All right, I think we did it. Go in peace and enjoy your forgiveness. Thank you for joining us for Bible Stories for Grownups, brought to you by St. John's Episcopal Church in downtown Tallahassee. We'll see you next week. Until then, remember, look for God, look for grace, and always keep God nearby.